Zoomers are sick of the malaise and nihilism of the age and of what we've grown up in. I am sick and tired, and so many other people my age are just exhausted with the nihilism and with the techno-pessimism. And so what I'll say is, like, EAC, God is good. The future will be better if you will it to be.
Happy New Year, and welcome to Product Market Fit, a podcast for early stage founders all about startups, technology, and growth. I'm your host, Moshe Poltorak, and we're kicking off the year strong with Augustus Dorigas, the 23-year-old founder of Rainmaker, a company looking to make it rain, literally. We talked about terraforming, techno-optimism, and EAC, or effective acceleration, and the future of our species on this planet. We discussed the challenges of building hard tech and what's going on in the movement's mini mecca, El Segundo, California, or as it's affectionately been dubbed, the Gundo. And we even cover religion and theology. I absolutely love this conversation, and I'm sure you will too. By the way, if you haven't yet done your annual review and planning, I'd recommend you listen to my last episode after this and do the exercise that I discussed with Jason Chen. Sometimes you gotta slow down to speed up, and there's no better way to set your year up for success than to spend a few hours intentionally taking inventory and setting goals. The Product Market Fit podcast is brought to you by Growth.co. That's growth without the O.co. Growth offers fractional CMOs paired with best-in-class digital marketing execution to support early-stage startup success. With a focus on seed and Series A companies, Growth has helped a number of SaaS, digital health, and e-commerce startups build their go-to-market function and scale up. To learn more and book a free consultation, go to growth.co. That's growth.co. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Augustus Dorigas. Hello, Augustus. Welcome to the show. So happy to have you on today.
Thanks, brother. Blessed to be here. Feeling excited and rejuvenated after Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. It's holiday season now. We're going into the new year. So a lot of optimism. And I am very excited about your startup and what you're working on. Fascinating stuff. To start us off, you're religious. I happen to be as well. Although I guess I'm glad you're not Jewish, because they already accused us of controlling the weather. So maybe it's better that you take you take this startup. But from a religious perspective, you think about the implication of quote unquote playing God, or is that an argument that you often get from certain critics?
Yeah, I hear people express concerns about playing God routinely, right? And I think it's a reasonable concern. Hubris is something that has led to many missteps in the past, both technologically and with respect to policy. And capping that as early and as consistently as I can within the company is something that is definitely like a large focus. What I would say, though, is it's almost as if you think the scope of God being the weather is so constraining, and it's preposterously constraining. Like, if controlling the weather is equivalence to God, I think your conceptualization of God's domain is far too small. And so what I would say instead is, you know, in my mission at Rainmaker, I'm not interested in playing God. I think that if you are religious, then you might be of the opinion that creating more well-being and prosperity for all of his creation and for everybody within it, whether you're secular or not, like, I want to help make the world better for God's sake and for the sake of everybody else. And so if we can control the weather in such a way that makes agriculture more viable, that makes, you know, ecology is more lush and flourishing, then that's something that I would love to do. And as long as we are interfacing with all of the stakeholders that are relevant, you know, be they local populations or governments or farmers that are affected, hydrological watersheds that are affected, that's what's important. And I think that we can do that in a safe manner.
You make a really good point about God's bigger than the weather, but to many people, especially historically, the weather was so complex and unpredictable and far reaching in terms of even today, right? The weather models with all of our capabilities today are still not perfect, and they're still making advances. I just heard on the All In Pod Science Corner, he was talking about some of the new advances with the weather modeling, thanks to some of these new generative AI models that are moving that science along. So the weather is complex, and that's why people kind of are afraid of, if you touch it, you don't know what the effects are. For example, if you use terraforming or cloud seeding or any sort of atmospheric engineering, if you're changing something here, there's going to be effects somewhere else, right? So if you drop rain over the desert, obviously it changes the desert, and that has all of its effects, but it also perhaps would take rain away from where it would have rained elsewhere. Or if you divert a hurricane from hitting Houston, where I am. You know, maybe it hits New Orleans instead, or maybe it hits Mexico. And who's to say, you know, what's the right decision on that front? I know we used to in the U.S. do stuff as it relates to cloud seeding to prevent hurricanes. So I think that actual moral dilemma has come up before. So I'm just wondering, how do you think about those kind of secondary effects and tertiary effects of your technology, of what you're going to be implementing?
Yeah, totally. Well, first of all, I do think about them, right? And I think that that's an important starting point, because there's plenty of people that just want to wantonly try to modify the climate without respect to, you know, second, third, nth degree effects. So start with that. Then the second thing that I would say is there is some validity to concerns about unknown impacts of modifying the weather, right? Like, if you do cloud seed in this area long term, how will that affect atmospheric rivers? How will that affect the hydrology over a given area, the cloud coverage, et cetera? What I can say is, with relative confidence, we can model these things out. Not perfectly, but year over year, month over month, we're getting better at modeling what the short, medium, long-term effects of any climatic change are, and also particularly those related to weather mod. And so we can conduct an operation with suspected outcomes and probability distributions of the different outcomes and say, okay, this we deem sufficiently safe because we're not going to be taking water from any other party. We're not going to be radically reducing the amount of cloud coverage that these local crops were reliant on. That's something that we can model out, but again, not perfectly. And so what I generally respond with when people bring this up, like the unknown potential outcomes, is, well, the known outcome is disaster, right? If we continue down the path that we're on, what we get is the aridification of the entire Central Valley and most of Western American agriculture. We lose the cities of Phoenix, Las Vegas, Tucson, maybe all of Salt Lake, right? Because we don't have enough water for them. Their groundwater supply is running out. Their surface water is running out. One other consequence of not having water in these cities is the respiratory problems that are a product of drying lake and riverbeds, right? So the Salt Lake, it's going the same way as the Salton Sea in California. So the Salton Sea was this huge inland sea that was created because of runoff from the Colorado River in like the Imperial Valley. And it was huge. There was bustling commerce. People went to it as a tourist attraction all the time. You could fish in it. Now, if you go there, I was there a couple months ago with John Coogan and company, the lake beds receded hundreds of feet because of how much it has receded. The concentration of toxins has increased radically just because there's less water in there. And as it recedes, the toxins are left behind in the silt of the seabed. And because it's silt, it's so fine, it gets kicked up by dust and people are breathing it. The amount of children with asthma is going up year over year because of it. And so if you're anti-children with asthma, not to like make straw men out of this, right? But like, if you don't want people to have severe respiratory problems, if you don't want the price of housing to go through the roof because we're not able to build anymore since there's no water, if you don't want the entire world, which is dependent on our agriculture, to starve or pay prices through the moon for agriculture, then at the very least, we ought to dedicate some research and some of our efforts to increasing the amount of precipitation, because the known outcome is disaster. The unknown outcome that we can model out, which looks pretty good, has risks associated, but at the very least, it's one that enables us to prevent this bad outcomes. And then in the best circumstance, right, it's one that enables us to thrive in a way that we haven't been able to ever in the past, right? Like, nobody, when they moved to California in 1890 or any time before that, suspected that the Central Valley would become the lush breadbasket that it is, where we get all of our pistachios, our almonds, tens and hundreds of thousands of heads of cattle every month. But because of the foresight and vision of some spectacular civil engineers that built the Cal State Water Project, we transformed that into one of the most productive regions in the country, right? In the world at that. And so what I would say again is, we need to avert this crisis that's impending. And then with some positive vision and cautioned vision, I think that we can build something that is beyond our wildest dreams with respect to agricultural and ecological flourishing via cloud seeding.
Yeah, I love that optimism. I know that you and I talked about it. It's easy to be a pessimist. It seems to be popular these days, in vogue. You get no points for it, right? It doesn't move anybody forward. And I feel as a society, we have kind of fallen into that trap where it's about risk mitigation and about minimizing use as opposed to taking calculated risks for an abundant future. And what you're doing with Rainmaker is one piece of that. I know it's been bubbling up recently in other areas around space exploration and becoming a multiplanetary species, and also about AI as kind of, is it an existential threat or is it our savior or is it somewhere in between? And nobody knows. But I like that there are brave people out there that are doing interesting and new things. So for the podcast, usually we interview folks that are a little further along, talking about like, you know, how they got to where they're at.
Product market fit.
Product market fit, right? You're still working on product, right? You haven't gone out to market yet. And it's probably going to be a few years of R&D before you actually have live pilots, I assume. I'm not.
Perhaps sooner. We'll talk about that publicly when the time comes.
When the time is right. Okay. Well, why don't you break down for us, for a startup that is heavy R&D, right? This is kind of deep tech. You have hardware, you have software, you have regulatory and political hurdles that you have to get over. What are the major steps that you foresee getting to? And I'm kind of thinking about it along the lines of Leo Polovitz kind of put me on this mindset of a startup is a series of de-risking exercises. So each stage you have a set of, okay, these are the three questions that we need to answer. Let's say feasibility, can we build it? Will it work? Whatever, right? There's the market risk. There's the channel risk. Can we acquire customers for a reasonable rate that supports the business model, right? So each of those components, can you kind of map out how do you get to your vision from where you're at right now?
Yeah. So let's break it down this way. Let's talk about the market. Let's talk about two different ways I think about product, and then let's talk about the regulatory aspects of things. With respect to the market, water is very easy to sell. I'll start by saying that, right? If you're a farm in the Central Valley or any of the American West, right, you either are running out of water and your business is an existential risk because you simply cannot provide for the crops that you've historically been able to. So you either need to reduce the amount of acreage that you till, let it all die and just abandon it, which is happening. And the Cal State water supply strategy specifically anticipates hundreds of thousands of acres going by the wayside because people just abandon it since there's no water available. So you're either in that circumstance or you're in the privileged circumstance of having plenty of water underneath you, but you're being penalized for using it because of how scarce the supply is. And so the state has levied penalties against you for pumping above your budget. So people are desperate for water in the American West. And that's just agriculture, right? Beyond that, there's the utilities that we haven't started to engage with much, will eventually. Thankfully, like last year, we had plenty of snowpack. We'd like to reliably provide that snowpack to all of the Sierras so that, you know, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, so that the LA Department of Water and Power, they continuously have snow that's melting that gives a consistent flow to their infrastructure. But that being said, like, they desperately want that, right? And other programs like Idaho Power, for example, has a extremely sophisticated, extremely robust cloud seeding program for the sake of ensuring snowpack into the Snake and Columbia River, where they have hydroelectric dams where they source a lot of water. So, you know, every conversation we've had with farms so far has been extremely validating. Like, rain's not a difficult thing to sell, but can you provide the rain? And so that is where, you know, I start to think about product. The first consideration with Rainmaker is the systems integration and logistics problem, right? Cloud seeding has existed for 70 years, and it's been rather crude, right? Like, we're either using planes or these sort of bonfires that spew chemicals up into the sky, and we hope enough of it gets to the cloud, and rarely does it ever. And so the yields that we've gotten historically from cloud seeding have not justified the cost. First of all, they've been almost immeasurable, right? Like, how do you quantify without really sophisticated radar how much rain you're getting? If the answer is rain gauges, like, that's one valuable source of data, but it's not statistically robust unless you have like every meter a rain gauge over an entire 100,000 acre property. So the way that we've done it before has had dramatically low yields, and moreover has just been like cost inefficient because of the way in which we deliver the chemical, because of the nucleation agents we use, that sort of thing. So the way we solve that is the systems integration, right? Like, we have some pretty sophisticated radar that we're rolling out onto these fields to identify conditions where we can seed. And then once we have seeded, measure how much rain falls that's purely man-made. And so with some fancy algorithms, we can differentiate between the conditions before seeding and after seeding and measure how much of that hits the ground very precisely within, you know, 100,000 gallons or so, plus or minus. And over the span of tens of thousands of acres, that's very precise. So there's the radar, there's the drone, which we have to fly up and make sure that it doesn't freeze in the cloud. We have to make sure that we can constantly monitor where it is, despite the turbulent conditions that it's flying through. Then we have to disperse the nucleation agent, right? That's a whole problem into itself, because we have to make sure it's not icing. We have to make sure that we don't disperse too much or too little, because that can either result in it not condensing enough water or condensing so much water that you prevent rainfall because because it'll all freeze into tiny crystals that aren't heavy enough to fall. So there's the radar, there's the drone, there's all the people on the ground that have to be monitoring this stuff. That's a real systems integration effort. And when we announce our first pilot, which will be soon, we'll get to talk a little bit about how we're managing all the logistics. And it's kind of one of those things where I was talking to my friend Zane Mountcastle. He runs a company called PicoGrid, and he used to do a lot of drone contracting for the DoD. And you just have to be out in the field to test it, right? Like, you can speculate as much as you want about, you know, conditions that may arise, but the fastest way to get data, the fastest way to get to product market fit when you're not there yet is just taking action, right? And so what we're doing for all of the spring in one way or another is like taking action to investigate how we integrate all these systems. So with respect to the market, that's simple. With respect to, you know, systems integration, that's just something that we have to test in field. Then I would say the deepest R&D that we have to do is with the nucleation agents. So traditionally, silver iodide is used, and silver iodide is relatively safe. If you're dispersing single-digit kilograms over tens of thousands of acres, it's an immeasurably trace amount that ends up in watersheds. But over time, if you're continuously seeding and you're trying to do these large-scale projects like we intend to, then you can start to see it accumulate in the watersheds. Then you start to have antibacterial effects. So long-term, it's not a viable thing for us to use. Based on the current ways in which we disperse it and our current modeling, maybe we can innovate in such a way where we need less silver iodide and then it becomes viable. But tentatively, we want something that is more efficient per gram that we can use in different operational contexts, so different seasons and geographies, and that's safer, right, for the ecologies over which we're seeding. That's something that we have to test in lab. Originally, we were considering doing a computational approach and simulating tens of thousands of different chemical agents to see how they perform at nucleating ice. We're competing with all of the LLM guys for GPUs, though. And so that is not as efficient a use of capital as just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. And so we have a slightly more sophisticated approach to identifying nucleation agents in lab. We're going to spend about the full year testing out a suite of 300 or so minerals and then some other biologics to see how they perform. That's something that I think towards the end of 24, we'll go out to try to patent. TBD on how to use those in field. And part of the reason why we're not yet sure about how we would approach using them in the field and testing them in the field is because of the regulations around it, right? And so that kind of gets into this fourth thing. The market's solved. The systems integration is just something that we have to test. We have a pretty robust plan about how we're going to develop new nucleation agents, but then getting them to market, that's one of the first things that involves us interfacing with government. And so what I'll say...
And specifically government, you're referring to EPA and local government or...
Mostly, I'm referring to state-level governments. So the states are largely responsible, bar NOAA, which is a federal entity, right? Bar NOAA, the states are largely responsible for governing their cloud seeding programs and determining what's approved, what you're allowed to use, when you're allowed to seed. What I think is worth saying first is, for some reason, I think perhaps just cultural differences between move fast and break things culture of Silicon Valley and maybe DC or Sacramento, startups have for a long time viewed themselves as like adversarial to states. And I think that that's kind of just a skill issue. People generally are interested in seeing their state's well-being improved, right? And the whole nation's well-being improved. And there's different ways in which people understand how to bring about that well-being. But like, if you go to regulators and you say like, you guys suck, approve my whatever it is, then like you're destined for failure. Whereas if you go to them and say, hey, here are the interests that you have, you know, a lot of your constituents, for example, are agricultural. Here's how we can help them. Here's some great ways where you've helped them. How do we collaborate on this? You know, time will tell how we perform at Rainmaker. So far, so good. But you can align the state to the interests of your company and get better outcomes for everybody that way. And so what we think about at Rainmaker is, you know, mostly NOAA. Obviously, there's some drone related regulations that are specific to federal regs and federal orgs, and then state level stuff. And what I'll say is, the burden of state regulations is real. Like, for example, Idaho has a totally laissez-faire approach to cloud seeding regulation. And so one thing that would be unfortunate that, you know, we'll see how it pans out in time. But one thing that would be unfortunate is if California, a significantly more water-stressed state than Idaho, wasn't able to benefit from cloud seeding at scale because of the bureaucracy there, where Idaho, which will benefit from it, but doesn't need it as desperately, can move fast. And so we're pretty aggressively starting to interface with the state for the sake of getting water to where it needs to go first, rather than just like arbitraging the best regulatory regime that we can operate in. And then with respect to, you know, nucleation agent design, you know, like we want something that's proven to be safe before everybody agrees to us using it. That seems like a reasonable threshold of regulatory oversight. And so we'll talk to them about that process as it goes on, both in Sacramento and in DC.
Going back to something you said about the market, can you provide rain at such pinpoint accuracy that an individual farm would be a customer? Or do you need like regions or co-ops to kind of band together in order for it to work with the model?
We can provide rain to individual farms. That said, larger targets are easier to precipitate over because there's more cloud coverage, there's less chaos in the system, so there's less variability in the gusts of wind that could take rain one way or another. So larger farms are easier to hit than smaller ones, but we can. And that's what our first pilots should be, large-scale commercial farms, individual large-scale commercial farms. Now, that being said, many large-scale commercial farms are not in as dire a strait as the smaller mom-and-pop operations that need water more desperately and that have less either surface water access or groundwater rights. And one thing that we'd like to do long-term is transition not from large-scale commercial farms and contracting with them, but instead selling to entire irrigation districts, selling to entire municipal utilities so that we can do two things. One, give ourselves an easier time, because if there's a larger target area over where we can seed, there's more opportunities for us. We don't have to be as on edge all the time, although we will always be quick responding. We'll have more opportunities to seed over a larger watershed. But then also, not only is it easier for us, if we're seeding over an entire watershed or an entire irrigation district or municipality, then the smaller stakeholders, the smaller farmers can benefit from that too, because where they either would not have the expendable budget to afford cloud seeding themselves or would have too small of a farm for us to consistently precipitate over it. If we're seeding the entire watershed, they can benefit from water that happens to hit their farm or that goes to the river or that percolates into the aquifer in their basin.
What about ski resorts? Is that the one customer segment or not really?
So ski resorts are one of the largest commercial buyers of cloud seeding in the United States right now. And, you know, if I could ensure that Alterra and Big Bear and Mammoth had snow all year round so that I could go ski on some of those, then I certainly would. And God willing, I will. That said, because they're some of the largest commercial buyers and they have vendors that they trust, they want a higher technology readiness level than what we had when we went out for our first LOIs and for our first agreements. So I think that, you know, circa November 24, we'll start having some serious conversations and perhaps operating with ski resorts to ensure there's fresh pow-pow for everybody there. Because you know what? If you do you ski or snowboard?
A little bit.
Okay, yeah. So like the fake snow, right? It's much icier. It's much more granular. If only for the sake of better quality of skiing and snowboarding, you would prefer cloud-seeded snow rather than the industrial snow blowers that they make. But then also, of course, longer seasonal operation is nice as well.
Everybody wants that fresh pow.
Exactly.
Yeah. Why now, right? Every technology has its moment and usually a convergence of different technologies and cultural shifts and potentially environmental shifts make something be the perfect time for it to suddenly just explode, right? This technology, cloud seeding, has existed, you said, for 70 years. There are competitors today that are already doing it. What technologies today are enabling you to do things in a completely different way or better way? And again, why now?
The components of the tech tree that were unlocked that have enabled Rainmaker to exist are of critical import, no question. We couldn't exist if it weren't for them. And I'll talk about them in a sec. But I think far more important than that is just the will. Like, I do not subscribe to I don't even remember the name. It occupies so little mind share in my head. Whatever the opposite of like great man theory is, I don't think it's societal forces and economic trends that created Napoleon, right? Or that led Elon to build a launch company, right? Like, I think that if you have that spark within you and you want to see the world made better, then no matter the circumstance that you're in, you can will into existence the future that you desire. And so what I'll say is Zoomers are sick of the malaise and nihilism of the age and of what we've grown up in, right? Like, I think millennials sort of caught some of that tail end 90s nostalgia, but it's just been horrible since anyone from like 2000 or later was born. And part of why Rainmaker now is just because I am sick and tired, and so many other people my age and around my age, older even, are just exhausted with the nihilism and with the techno-pessimism. And so the foremost reason why now is just because, like, we have decided it is time to control the weather for the sake of making the planet better. And you could have done that, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and willed into existence the technologies that would have facilitated that. I'll also say one, like, climatological reason, one reason beyond just like force of will and having that iron in you that has led to Rainmaker's creation is like the aridification of many historical agricultural basins, right? If there's less precipitation in the Colorado River watershed, and if there are climate trends that result in like continued warming and subsequent like accelerated aridification and reduced precipitation, the need to intervene in many different climate modifying ways becomes severe enough that people will take action to do it. You know, if traditionally you had abundant groundwater and surface water, why bother dealing with like the crazy mulleted guy that's talking about making it rain over your farm? But like, if you don't have those two things, then you're willing to pursue more exotic solutions. So, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures. Then what I'll say about the tech is the following. One, obviously the total explosion of UAV development facilitates much cheaper delivery of nucleation agents to cloud. So we're benefiting from the Herculean work that decades of drone engineers have been putting in. That's one thing that's important. Even more important than that, though, was a project called Snowy that operated in Piatt Mountains in Idaho, right? And so for the longest time, the attribution problem was major in cloud seeding, meaning, you know, if you throw some dust in the sky and it rains, that doesn't mean that you caused it to rain. And then even if you did cause it to rain, how much value you produced was always immeasurable. No good. You can't commercialize business based off of, you know, pixie dust and hope. Even if the microphysics are well understood, right? Like, we understand what conditions yield different crystals, but how much of those ice crystals hit the ground is, or at least has historically been, too vague.
I'm going to take a jab at the advertising industry because they've created many businesses that have zero attribution, but a different type of attribution.
Yeah. Sure. This is fair. I would even say that cloud seeding, unfortunately, has been optimism around cloud seeding and misaligned incentives in like the 60s, 70s, 80s is part of what led to it falling off, right? Because we understood the microphysics so well, people operating these businesses didn't feel the burden of proof, or didn't feel as though they needed to provide proof to their commercial stakeholders. And eventually the commercial stakeholders who were getting fair feedback from the academic community realized, like, it's impossible to say with confidence that these results are really valid. And so what Rainmaker, one thing that we're really concerned about is like very close interfacing with the academic community to ensure that, like, even if we understand the microphysics, we're robustly and scientifically approaching the problem, all of the problems, but specifically attribution, so that our end user knows how much value they're getting. And so Snowy is largely our inspiration for that. They were clever enough to develop like one procedural innovation and one technological innovation, which facilitated like attributing exactly how much rain and or snow they produced. And so the technological innovation is just like portable high resolution radar and radar analysis, right? So they have these huge trucks that they were able to plop down over the area in which they were seeding, measure exactly the conditions that they were looking for in cloud, and then upon seeding, get a very clean signature of the phase change of water to ice, and then measured how much of that fell to the ground. So the high resolution radar is of critical import. We didn't have that in the 60s and 70s, even the 80s, really. Certainly not mobile either. And then the procedural innovation that they had was flying their plane perpendicular to the crosswind back and forth. And so what they hypothesized they would see in Snowy was this sort of zebra pattern of lines with uniform spacing of precipitation. And they did see that, and they were able to measure, like I said, within plus or minus like 100,000 gallons, how much they produced. So I think in one instance, it was, you know, 100 acre feet, and another it was like 121 acre feet. That's hundreds of millions of gallons of water just from a day's operation. Snowy, which was conducted between 2017 and 2021, really 2017, and then the analysis happened later, was the critical unlock technologically that I would not have started Rainmaker without, because they solved attribution. We have to replicate that. We will this upcoming year in some pilots, maybe. But that was the big why now technologically.
Going back to techno-optimism, you said something that struck me, that Zoomers see technology and techno-optimism as a challenge to the nihilism that they've been, I guess, forced to consume or inculcated in. Probably a lot of that is kind of like the climate crisis and a lot of the negativity that goes around that. And of course, the leading narrative there is about conservation and reduction and degrowth. To me is a horrible ideology instead of looking for technological solutions and an abundance mindset that will help us get to. Bezos recently said on Lex Fridman's podcast, he was interviewed and he was talking about the need for humans to become an interplanetary species. And for him, it was a obvious need if humans are going to become a species of 100 billion to a trillion in population, it's not going to happen on this planet alone. And that kind of mindset, if you start from where do we want to go and how can we get there, as opposed to like, you know, what's the impending doom that's around the corner and you know, let's be afraid of that. What technologies, movements, or people in that space, whether it's in the EAC specific space as it relates to AI or just general techno-optimism, what's got you excited?
I mean, before even saying that, I'll say like Bezos is wrong. Like the carrying capacity of Earth is whatever we want it to be, which isn't to say that like we could mismanage our way and stumble into, you know, 100 billion people on the planet while also just spewing coal ash everywhere. But there's an essay from Palladium called The Garden Planet. It talks about like new approaches to managing the environment. And I think that it sounds it, but it's not ludicrously aspirational to envision an Earth with 100 billion people on it that are thriving and have plenty of living space. It's not like a, you know, you will own nothing and be happy because you live in a pod and eat bugs type situation in the future. Like if we turn the Mojave, the Sahara, the Gobi Desert, et cetera, into arable land, which isn't to say that we would do that to all of it, but if we do, or at the very least increase the productive output of the land that we have, I think that we can thrive on Earth in a way that has been previously very infrequently ideated about. Right. And so I'm all for becoming multiplanetary. I love SpaceX. I love Elon Musk. I love everybody that's trying to build launch and space tech. But I also think that we can thrive on Earth. And I also think that we can build like a terrapunk future on Earth where there's symbiosis between the environment and mankind. Right.
Just to add to that, I think that what you're describing is predicated on energy abundance as well, right? So we're not just talking about water. So in order for that world to exist, probably nuclear is a big part of that. Nuclear unlocks desalination and a bunch of other things. So it's not just, you know, it's a single technology.
Yo, totally, totally. And I'm pro all sorts of tech. I would say that climate mod tech is what I'm obviously most excited about. And so that sort of encompasses atmospheric engineering, that encompasses people doing carbon capture and alternative energy sources to change the amount of greenhouse gases we emit, that sort of thing. I actually share space with Isaiah Taylor from Valor Atomics, and he is doing fission-based atmospheric CO2 capture for methane synthesis. So net zero methane synthesis, super excited about his company and the energy that will come from that. I think it'll probably take a little bit, but he should make energy free soon enough that we have plenty of power for our kids. And so, yeah, like, What has me excited? I think if I were to break it out into concentric circles, like first of all, it's the Gundo. El Segundo is, you know, the mecca for hard tech for like those that are religious about it. It's the Florence for those that view like the return of atoms and technology as this renaissance. And, you know, maybe you guys are tired of hearing me shill about it at this point, but I love it here. And the more people that come to build great things, the better we'll be. But part of why like I started the company here is because it already was this spectacular place. And so like what that means is the legacy of El Segundo is obviously the Chevron refinery, which was the Standard Oil refinery. So there's tons of chemical engineers that are doing great stuff there. There's tons of power available. Then also NASA stood up tons and tons of warehouses for the space shuttle program. And so there's not infinite, but there's tons of 1,000 to 6,000 square foot facilities for people to build pre-seed Series A hard tech businesses, to do serious tinkering. Got U-line tables all over the place that are like our early chem lab here. Then because of, you know, I mentioned before, I had a nose cone that I got from one of my vendors for our drone. The carbon fiber was punctured. I walked three blocks that way to Cambium, the guys that are doing all sorts of composites and carbon fiber work. I don't know anything about that, or I didn't at the time. And I said like, hey, is this shot? How do I fix it? Do I have to wait another month for them to manufacture a replacement nose cone? And in 5 minutes, they were like, nope, this is how you fix it. Walked me through everything. Got the carbon fiber right here. So when we get off the phone, I'll fix this thing up. The amount of shared knowledge and resources is spectacular. And everybody has the mutual vision of like a much more abundant future. And they're building it with their hands, which is so symbolic. And so I would say the Gundo is super exciting to me.
And you're right near LAX, right? Just bordering.
Yeah. LAX. Okay. So Chevron is to the south, LAX is to the north. So there's consistently air traffic going in and out. Love to watch that. Super convenient if you have to
fly out to investor meetings or
take,
whatever.
If you have to suffer the indignity of going to San Francisco, then it's easy to do that. Then there's the Pacific to the west and one of the most sophisticated water treatment plants in the world, the Hyperion Water Reclamation Plant. Obviously, I'm a nerd about that. They export 20 megawatts of power that they generate via biofuel, right? So they take in fecal matter, they have a bunch of methanotrophic bacteria that consume it, emit methane, they burn the methane. So net positive power output. Then to the east, you have all the defense primes, you have, you know, BAE, Lockheed, Boeing, etc. You have, you know, all of Hawthorne, which is sort of where, like, slightly larger. I wouldn't say that people are graduating from El Segundo. I'll be here as long as I can. But if you need, you know, 40,000 square feet or more, Hadrian is out there and they're doing some of the coolest automated CNC machining work that I've ever seen. Radiant's just on the border of El Segundo and Hawthorne. So they're doing some awesome work. There's so much talent and so many resources. So I love all that. And then I would say the next concentric circle out from that, which encompasses even a lot of San Franciscans, is like EAC in general, right? And so I am super grateful to, you know, Beth and Baze, the founders of this intellectual online movement on twitter.com or x.com, because even though they talk about some ridiculous things like a thermodynamic God, which I think is, you know, sort of like idolatrous and probably they should just worship God instead, that movement is responsible for so much more optimism and insistence on building real things. So, you know, the guys in SF or Austin or even New York that are EAC, everyone's trying to accelerate the future that we want to see. And I tweeted something this morning that sort of exemplifies like the technological acceleration that, I don't know, it made it feel much more real than I had realized before. I was reading The Martian, like I said. They reference ULA, right? Like United Launch Alliance, and how they just can't get ULA to build boosters in time to go for this rescue mission, not to spoil anything from The Martian. But I was like reading that and I was like, ULA? Like SpaceX launches every few days, right? Like we are becoming spacefaring way faster than Andy Weir had suspected. And so there's all these technologies that EAC people are building that I think will make the 21st and 22nd century spectacular, as long as we can keep willing it into existence. And then I'd say beyond even EAC, I'm super grateful to X and to Twitter beyond EAC, just because it enables really strong filtration for similar mindset and similar preferences. Like most of the guys that have moved to El Segundo, I met on Twitter, and we're super aligned on the sort of lives that we wanted to live, the companies we wanted to build, largely religious conviction. Like, you know, Isaiah is one of the most faithful Christians I know, and super grateful for that. I think that Twitter is like, if this is trite, people have said it before, but like the new valley, right? Like if you want to build a company, if you want to raise, being on X definitely helps with that. So those are the concentric circles. And then I'll also say, like, just having my church community has been great, because, you know, no matter whether or not I build a company that, and no matter whether or not Rainmaker actually ends up fulfilling its mission, and it will, to terraform deserts, right? Like at the end of the day, like salvation comes from not like our work per se, but like from a generous and benevolent God. And so that is something that I take solace into.
Very cool. You had founded Terra Seco prior to Rainmaker, and I think that kind of led you down that rabbit hole of fascination with water and all of its value and power. Where is that company currently? Are you still involved? And what lessons have you learned? Obviously, very different business. That's a kind of vertical SaaS. But any lessons learned that you care to share?
Yeah, sure. So co-founded that business with two guys that were in the water well drilling industry in Texas. Sold my interest in that earlier this year. The primary lesson, I would say, is just like move faster. Part of why I sold my interest in the business was just because we weren't moving as fast as I thought we could. And after having operated at Rainmaker for, I think, like 287 days, I've realized every day you can operate faster than you previously realized. And I think Sam Altman talks about that. So first lesson, just move faster. We had some supply problems, right? Like we couldn't get enough hardware at a given point in time. I would say as well, I've done better at Rainmaker, but still need to improve on managing timelines so that we're never waiting on hardware. That's one thing that I learned at Terra Seco that I'm still relearning at Rainmaker, because that's just like a stupid delay. That's a really, really bad way to spend capital, just like sitting on your hands, which we don't do, right? But like that should never be the rate limiter. And so I would say I learned that. I also learned that ag is not a hard market to sell into. People traditionally say like, oh, it's hard to sell to farmers, right? And that's largely like, from what I can tell, famous last words, maybe I'll never sell to another farm again. But from what I can tell, right, because we were selling to those people at TerraSeco, we still are at Rainmaker. If you think it's hard to sell to farmers, you might just be in an ivory tower. Like those are just smart people that run multi-million dollar businesses that are a little bit wary of Silicon Valley because they've been burned before and because those aren't people that are familiar with their industry or way of life. If you're willing just to like actually spend time with your customer and get to know them, you can earn their trust and provide them value much more easily than I think the Valley generally suspects. So those are the two big lessons from the TerraSeco. And so it's still in Texas operating some wells all over the country right now.
But you're not involved?
No.
And then last one here before we get to the lightning round. You mentioned before being thankful to X, or formerly known as Twitter. Your approach to that channel, is it a way to vent? Is it a marketing, branding strategy? A little bit of everything, because you're pretty active and you've got some creative shit posts as well as really thoughtful, optimistic, techno-optimist posts as well. So what's feeding that strategy?
You know, I love my team to death at Rainmaker. Like these are some of the most spectacular hires. I mean, they're better than I thought I could have gotten. And I was going to be very selective from the start. And two of four of them right now are from Twitter, are from X. So what I would say first and foremost is like, it's just being earnest. It's just like a fun way to engage with my friends and make friends. But then beyond that, like I'm aware of the power that X has because in some part I was able to raise because of it. I've been able to hire because of it. So what I'll say now is like trying to, Steve Jobs talks about this, like constantly re-articulate the vision for what you're trying to do to attract like-minded people that are willing to work obsessively and suffer for the sake of building the future that needs to be built. Like that's what I'm most concerned about on X. And also bragging about my lifts. I'm a big weightlifter too.
That's right. You used to be a personal trainer, right?
Yes, I was. I was.
What's your current max on the bench?
315 for one.
Pretty good. I don't know.
not you got to start training, man.
Yeah.
You got to start training.
I got the basics going. That's a step for me. Everybody's, it's not the end state. It's the direction, right? So I'm on the right direction.
This is true. Well, next time you're in Los Angeles, you're welcome to use our squat rack.
Appreciate that. Thank you. We'd like to close out with an exciting lightning round. I'll ask you some questions. Tell me the first thing that comes to mind. Sound good?
Yeah.
What book, newsletter, and or podcast do you find yourself recommending most often?
Notes from the Underground by Dostoevsky, for sure. I think that gets into human nature in a way that is really important. Then the Foundation series is just good sci-fi. Newsletter, I forget what it's called, but Casey Hammer's blog is great. I would recommend that for anyone that wants to think about cool engineering and science problems brought into real life.
Awesome. What's a piece of terrible advice that you've received?
Terrible advice that I've received? Oh, interesting. I've gotten a lot of good advice. I think that some bad advice has been to like stop re-articulating the vision, right? Like I think that there's some founders, maybe more of the like Wozniak types that are exclusively concerned about product and building. And obviously I'm like radically concerned about product. I have stacks of research papers that I'm reading all the time so that I know like the nitty gritty of the product. But I think that especially for single solo founders and then other companies, if you aren't talking about the vision and if you have anybody that's motivated by the vision rather than just pure engineering problems, and sometimes you can hire engineers that are just rote engineers that have no like philosophical aspirations, that works. But I think that it has been for the better to constantly motivate people on the team by reminding them like the future that we're aspiring for rather than just talking about like an AWS implementation that'll be slightly faster for one of our models.
So the advice was to stop talking about the vision, stop reiterating.
Yep.
Who's a mentor of yours who's had the most impact on your life or career?
Yeah, that's a good one. I would say in a pretty short amount of time, Joshua Steinman has been extremely influential. I was a goofball. I am a goofball sometimes still, but like I was really a goofball when I first moved to Los Angeles, didn't know the first thing about building a business, didn't know about venture, didn't know about tech, didn't know about publicity at all. He was very generous to me and continues to be with his advice. And so I'm grateful for that from him for sure. And he's building a company called Galvanic in Los Angeles as well. They do cybersecurity for industrials.
Very cool. Last one here. What's one question that I didn't ask that you wished I'd ask.
You didn't ask what my squat was. I could squat 485. That's a good question.
485. Is that four plates, six plates? What is that?
That's almost five plates.
Five plates.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's that one. I guess one that we can get into in a subsequent episode might be like, well, how do you really terraform, right? Like, is it just cloud seeding, or what stack of technologies do you need to integrate to really change an ecosystem for the better? And that's something that I think about a lot.
All right. Well, we'll get you back on in the future for that. Augustus, I really enjoy this. This is fascinating stuff. Love your optimism and boldness and what you're trying to accomplish. You are probably the youngest founder that we've had on the podcast. Definitely the best mullet we've had on the podcast so far. Thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with me and sharing what you're building. If you want to close us out with any final words, and how can people reach you if they want to continue the conversation or learn more about Rainmaker, I'll put all those links in the show notes.
Sure. I would just say EAC. God is good. The future will be better if you will it to be. If you're a spectacular electrical engineer, mechatronics engineer, chemical engineer, mechanical engineer, send me an email at augustus@makerain.com or find me on Twitter, DM me. I'm active there at @adorico. And otherwise, thanks for having me, brother.
We'll talk soon. Happy New Year.
Thanks. You too, man.
That's a wrap. Are you as optimistic about the future as I am? What's got you most excited going into 2024? Let me know with a quick email to hello@pmfpod.com or DM me on LinkedIn or X. I always love to hear from you. And if you want to learn more about what growth.co can do for your startup, check out grwth.co. As always, wishing you rocket ship success on your startup journey. See you next week.